Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on list.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
What always stands out to me about this day and about Dr. King is his courage. His courage to make a stand. And I love that. I love that part of it. I just think there's such a message in there of fighting for what you believe in, fighting for what is right, and fighting for injustice and inequality.
Idiot! We need to enjoy Jim Boylan while we can. Because I don't think he's going to be around long. Just like we tried to enjoy Terry Bevington as White Sox fans, you try to enjoy Tim Beckman at the University of Illinois. When you get one of these, You got to lean in. You got to enjoy the fact that he's got Martin Luther King fighting for injustice and inequality.
You know what he meant? He didn't mean that. He meant the other thing. Fighting against it.
That's Jim Boylan, American treasure. Danny LaRue writes about the NBA and the Golden State Warriors for the Athletic San Francisco, multimedia basketball superstar. He's on Twitter at Danny LaRue. He's on the Bernstein and McKnight show now. What's going on, Danny? How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. How are you guys?
Good.
Wonderful.
So the Bulls trade for Carmelo Anthony, but he's not going to play for the Bulls. Maybe they're going to shop the contract, or maybe they end up waiving him, but it appears that the Reinsdorfs have decided to allow their flexibility to move a contract so they get like $1 million out of it. What is this seemingly endless cycle of meaningless activity?
Well, I mean, it is pretty amazing if you could kind of sit back for a second to realize that Carmelo Anthony was moved in a deal where the most important thing was money. You know, like not for him, but just cash going to the Chicago Bulls. And this is a direct parallel to the deal that these same two teams made a few weeks ago. And that was when Chicago took on Michael Carter Williams shortly before his contract guaranteed. And in both deals, the reason the trade happened was because Houston, due to the way the NBA counts salary, they now do not have to pay the luxury tax on the entire amount that they signed Carmelo and Michael Carter Williams for. So they save a ton of money. They transferred some of that money they saved in a manner like kind of you could think of it from a bookkeeping perspective to Chicago. And so that's the benefit for the Bulls. And in both of these cases, since the player was making a minimum contract, you can theoretically trade that to anybody with an open roster spot. So I don't think the Bulls had enough leverage to demand, let's say, a second-round pick or a talented young player, because almost anybody could have made the trade.
So this doesn't then signal a way the Bulls want to work with either their cap space, roster space, or anything else as we approach the deadline here. This is just an opportunity they figured they'd seize because they can. It's not a rework of how they're approaching anything?
I wouldn't think so, no. I mean, maybe you could think of it in a broader sense that if Carmelo's representation represents anybody interesting, that making them happy by getting him out of Houston and facilitating some of that, maybe that you could go in that direction. But other, you know, beyond those sorts of machinations, not really. It doesn't affect anything in Chicago's books beyond this year. And it looks like Chicago made money off of this deal, so then you don't have to think about it as like any sort of sacrifice.
I wonder what it means around the league to be a willing partner in some of these things. Is there any political capital that's gained here? Because I know that sometimes we don't really appreciate the significance of the role of the ownership level in setting the tone for a team's success or not. But I wonder the statement that it says around the league, like, yeah, call the Bulls, they'll help you out on something. Is it a good thing, a bad thing, or does it mean nothing?
I think it's vaguely a good thing because the hope is that if teams always call you, maybe a team's going to call you with an offer that isn't a good idea for them. And that sort of thing can happen. I mean, pre-existing relationships can be a big part of negotiations. An example that's in my head is Kevin McHale trading Kevin Garnett to the Celtics? You know, I'm sure he and Danny Ainge had conversations. You know, there was an open line of communication there. That's an extreme example. But maybe something along those lines. But just having positive relationships around the league is a good thing. But the thing to remember is that general managers have a lot on their plates. They have a lot of incentives. And they're going to make the move that is best for them, regardless of whether that corresponding GM is their best friend or their worst enemy in the league.
Speaking of good relations, I read the piece on The Athletic about the patch-up that Kevin Durant and Draymond Green have gone through. They have shared a glass of wine. They have apparently patched things up, and good for them. Just how much of a weight was that on the team, and how much did it stand to be going forward if it had lasted? I find it difficult to, because they're such a central team in the league's whole pantheon, I don't know if we're overdoing something with them because they're as good as they are, or if they would have gotten past this because they're as good as they are.
I think they would have gotten past it just because of the incentives involved, you know, with how good this team is and what they're looking to accomplish. But I think what made this different than some of the other conflicts, I mean, you could go back to some of the public airing of grievances with Draymond and Steve Kerr. But because Kevin Durant is a newer addition and that his fit within this whole framework is a little bit less clear. You know, a lot of the other guys on the Warriors have been together for a much longer time. You know, Draymond, Steph Curry, and Klay Thompson were all drafted by the Warriors. They've been together for a long time. Durant, you know, he's only been around a couple of years. So it's a different dynamic. I think they're still figuring out where he is, not necessarily as a player, but really as a person. And it also amplifies because Durant is a free agent in a few months, and he can use whatever criteria he wants to pick his destination, whether that's in the Bay Area or somewhere else. And so if this sort of thing matters to him, then he can use it in his decision.
I asked this question earlier just as we were playing the highlights of Klay Thompson hitting his first 10 threes. Where would the cutoff be if you say, and fairly so, that this current Golden State Warriors team has three of the best 5, 10, 15 shooters ever in the history of the NBA? Even as we include Reggie Miller and Ray Allen and any old-timer you want to talk about, in whatever order you want, Curry, Durant, Thompson, are these three of the top 5 ever? Are these three of the top 20 ever? It's remarkable no matter where we are, but what would your cutoff be, being completely fair and honest about it?
I think it's somewhere between 10 and 5. I mean, those guys are all ridiculous.
My God.
Something to consider with Durant is how impossible it is to block his shot. I mean, because the release point, he's an amazing shooter. He's 7 feet tall. He gets up for it. And so that is another factor for me in terms of dominance as a shooter. Klay is probably the hottest shooter in NBA history. I don't think he's better than Steph Curry because the degree of difficulty on off-the-dribble threes is something special. But yeah, thinking about it just briefly, I would say I wouldn't fight anybody who said they were three of the top 10. You get into top 5, then there are only two other guys, so that might be a little bit strong for me.
Tom Haberstroh just posted this, calling it the Warriors' Boogie Death lineup. And so it's known as their smaller death lineup, but it's with Boogie Cousins in there. This is in the land of small sample size mathematical fun. In 18 minutes so far, the Warriors have outscored opponents 55-20. And looking at the per 100s, their offensive rating is 131. The defensive rating, 45.5. That is a net advantage of 85.5. Opponents have shot 6 of 36, including 1 of 12 from three-point range, and have 10 turnovers in 18 minutes. Again, it's just fun with small sample sizes, but that's pretty ridiculous.
It is ridiculous, and I mean, they're not going to get to face the Lakers without all of their real good shot creators very often, so that is going to factor in it. But I think for people who are going to watch this lineup moving forward, what you want to keep an eye on is Draymond Green's defense, because really he had, in the Lakers game in particular, he had the onus on him of, I need to clean up whatever messes come. And teams are going after DeMarcus Cousins a lot, and they should. He is a point of attack in that Warriors defense. And if Green can patch up those holes, and they'll fiddle around with some other variants here, maybe with Andre Iguodala and other things, if they can hold up defensively, I don't think we have much of a doubt that team is going to score a lot of points, because it's a ridiculous collection of talent. DeMarcus Cousins is amazing, and we haven't gotten to see him as a complimentary Moore-style piece, you know, other than a little bit of time in New Orleans, depending on how Gentry structured those lineups. And so if they can figure out the defense, this could be something really special.
Hey, Danny, what's the national perspective, your perspective, I guess, from the outside, looking at Wendell Carter Jr., who may have his season end with surgery on his thumb? It sounds like it's going to be a couple of weeks for him, a good long time, if he does come back at all. Was that a... What does the pick look like to you? How does the fit look like to you? We may be wrapping up the first-round picks season much sooner than you'd wanted.
So I wasn't super high on Carter as a draft prospect. I actually saw him a little bit when he was in high school and college in person. And what really impressed me in summer league and continued into his NBA season is that he showed more athleticism and more applied athleticism than I expected. And in the modern NBA, for a center or any other position, that's really important, how quickly you can cover space. And so defensively, I liked a lot of what I saw. And, you know, maybe not that, like, defensive player of the year level, but a positive offense, a positive defensive player at the center spot is very important. Offensively, I still like a lot of the tools he has. I mean, I think he was an 80% free throw shooter in college. You know, I'm not as focused on, I think he made a lot of his threes too, but that was like 35 or something like that, you know, attempts. So I think what he's going to, my most likely thing is that he ends up being a positive defensive player and maybe, you know, a neutral, slight positive, slight negative on offense. And that's really good for a center. You know, it's not superstar, maybe not all NBA, but that's a really important player for this team. And something that, I mean, I could throw back to you guys, but I've been wondering myself is what Chicago's identity is going to be when they up this talent level. And having a capable defensive center is a really important part of a successful team, whatever level that ends up being.
Talking about centers, this is something that we had discussed after the Bulls played Denver. Where is Nikola Jokic on the all-time list of great unathletic players? I mean, it's just so much fun to watch a guy. If you scouted his traits, if you put him through a combine and you tested his leaping and his three-cone drill for quickness or sprint speed, you know, arm length, all that stuff, you wouldn't go near, you'd say it's a rec league player, and then you watch him in the NBA and he's a magician. So have you ever seen any, what are your comps for Jokic?
I mean, it's kind of an easy one considering they're both from broadly the same area, but late career Arvydas Sabonis, when he came into the NBA, is another guy who you wouldn't have, I mean, both big dudes, which is something to consider. I mean, Jokic is, last time when I saw him in person, I thought he was a legit 7 feet, maybe. Yeah, I don't think he was 7'1". But what both of those guys have is the brain for being a really high-level NBA player. The basketball IQ that Jokic has and seeing passes in particular before they come is really impressive. And there are more athletic players who have that type of thing. I mean, LeBron is a good example. I think even Draymond Green, though he doesn't do it all the time offensively, defensively, he can see things coming. That's the kind of level that Jokic is at. And what we see from him is that if you combine that kind of basketball intelligence with a really high skill level, even if it's not in terms of, like, you know, driving to the basket or something like that, because other people can do it more quickly, you can build a really, really good NBA player. And that same intelligence and anticipation, it hasn't made him a great defensive player, but it has made him a competent and better than that often piece of a very good defense, which they've been when Paul Millsap has shared the floor with him.
LeBron James hasn't played for the Lakers since, I think it's Christmas Day.
Yeah, he got hurt on Christmas.
Sounds like Rondo's coming back at some point this week. What are your expectations for the LA Lakers?
They're going to have a fight on their hands to make the playoffs, and I did not anticipate that. I thought the Lakers were going to be pretty comfortable, but that's also because I've long thought that LeBron is a cyborg who can't get hurt like that.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So they're going to have, I mean, because offensively, defensively, they're piecing a lot of this together, and Rondo can create better than the players that they had on the floor without Lonzo on Monday, but I'm not sure if he's going to be able to really do it by himself. But once they get LeBron back and Rondo, I think they'll be fine. I haven't looked at their schedule yet. But basically what I always say when a guy is out for a long time, obviously there are the impacts of that. But the other thing it does is that it makes any subsequent injuries even more consequential. And so once they get LeBron and Rondo back, the Lakers can't really afford any other injuries. And we know the NBA, that's, you can't guarantee that, and that's going to be really hard for them. But if they can stay healthy, I still think they'll be in.
Danny, this is really good. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Danny.
Thanks for having me on.
Danny LaRue.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.